I had received many reports of their coming close to the ground in such areas. Although I did not question that these craft were manned by human beings like ourselves, it was beyond my fondest hope to meet one of them. When the scout craft came in close, I quickly took pictures of it and hoped they would be good, since I was not then, nor am I today, a professional photographer. These were plates, and I put each one in my jacket pocket as I took it from my camera. It takes no stretch of the imagination to realize my excitement, as well as the strain under which I labored to talk with this man, since, apparently, he did not understand our language. Communication had to be by means of telepathy. After carrying on a conversation in this manner for several minutes, we approached his waiting ship, which was not far away. In spite of his warning to stay away from the hovering craft, I turned to speak to him and got my shoulder caught in the power emanating from the scout, whose outer edge was a little above my head. Although I realized I might suffer harm from this radiation, my greatest concern was for the exposed film plates in my jacket pocket. Automatically I took these out of my pocket to put them in one on my other side. As I did so, this friendly man from Venus extended his hand as a request for one. I understood his gesture and held them all out for him to help himself. He took one. Upon returning home and sending the film to my photographer for processing, I found that all of Dye negatives were blurred, much as if they had been exposed to X-ray. 23 days after this first meeting, Dye Scout returned, this time to my home, and I was able to take some good pictures, using my telescope with my camera. Imagine my surprise when the little ship approached close to where I was standing. A portal opened and my friend dropped the encased negative which he had taken after our first meeting. Upon processing by my photographer, the original exposure was found to have been washed off and symbols, similar in character to those in his footprints, were in its place. At the time I had no idea concerning the message these symbols contained. Nor did I know of others anywhere on Earth. As the years have passed, many people throughout the world have endeavored to decipher them. Most of these, however, were psychic in nature and far from being accurate, according to information from the space travelers. In 1956, while vacationing in Mexico, I received a letter from Spain, telling of a man there who had had a personal meeting with a man from a scout ship, and inquiring if it could have been the same space visitor who had met me in the desert in 1952. In this case, the visitor had given the Spaniard a beautiful and strange stone on which unfamiliar characters had been carved. A photograph of the stone enclosed in the letter showed the symbols to be similar to those I had been given. Within the past couple of years I have learned of a book, Dye Son Dare Son, by Marcel F. Hermit, in which is reproduced a plate of symbols found in Argentina. In certain respects this plate of symbols is identical to those on the negative dropped from the scout. This book is published in German only, so far as I can find out, and deals with ancient culture in the Amazon area. Thus another link is added to the chain of facts tying interplanetary communications and relations with past civilizations on Earth, whose records for the most part have become lost through the centuries or were destroyed deliberately. One of the main reasons for these symbols being given to me was to provide the concrete evidence that the space travelers knew our people demand. Since many of them have developed their natural talent of telepathy far beyond our understanding on Earth, they actually know us better than we know ourselves. This is because when any of them decide to come to Earth, either for short visits or long stays, they take the time and effort to become well acquainted with our customs and ways of thinking. They knew that the photographs which I had taken of their ships would serve well for some. On the other hand, there would be many, as there were, who would declare that they were the results of my imagination, that I had built models and photographed them. Of course this has been proven false, and today several nations are building craft of the same design as the Scouts, which were first said to be contrary to all laws of aerodynamics, and thus incapable of space travel. The symbols would add weight to the evidence of the planets, and also serve as a necessary link between our present experiences with interplanetary visitors and ancient records now being unearthed. As might be expected, there have been a few sincere people who have worked long and hard for a factual interpretation of this writing from another world. 1. A scientist in Africa worked with prints of the symbols, both those on the negative and those in the footprints, before coming up with an interpretation that was confirmed by the brothers. By using each symbol on the negative as a piece for a jigsaw puzzle, he was able to construct a diagram for a scout. Adding the symbols in the footprints, he secured the pattern for a large mother ship. As he continued studying and rearranging the symbols, he received ideas regarding the propulsion used in these craft, and the manner in which the power was controlled. As he put his ideas into experimental research, he reported amazing progress, although he did not give me any details. When I last heard from this man about a year ago, he was still working with the symbols and stated that his experiments had led him into certain unscientific findings that he was keeping in notes. When he had the time and opportunity, he planned on writing a textbook on his findings, since, he said, they would drastically change a number of presently accepted theories. After accomplishing this, he hoped to visit me in America. I am looking forward with interest to his visit. From Japan I received a beautiful scroll in which, so far as I could get it translated, the symbols were interpreted in relation to some of the ancient history and philosophies of certain parts of the Orient. The brothers have acknowledged that some history of ancient civilizations on Earth, as well as some of the philosophy of those civilizations, which conforms to that known on their planets and lived today by the people there, were included in the symbols. So, although even today I am unable to give a complete explanation of the symbols left with me so many years ago, perhaps they have served their purpose. The brothers express satisfaction. Yet, as we progress spaceward and eventually reach our neighboring planets, we in time will learn their languages, and then the full import of the symbols from space, as well as those ancient ones from our own planet, will be learned by the people of Earth. 7. Answers for the skeptics. When the satellites and high-altitude balloons began to relay accurate data from outer space, quite a few revisions had to be made in scientific thinking. This chapter deals with a few of those revisions. Those readers who have followed the seesaw course of acceptance and rejection pursued by officials when the spacecraft appeared, will recall how certain die-hard skeptics tried to shout down or explain away the sightings and contacts. When Flying Saucers Have Landed was published in 1953, describing my first contact with a visitor from the planet Venus, the skeptics brought out huge files of data to prove conclusively that life could not exist on that planet, because its atmosphere supposedly contained no water and no oxygen, only carbon dioxide. The discovery of water vapor in the atmosphere of Venus by U.S. scientists, during November 1959, led the experts to concede that some sort of life might exist on Venus. Within 2 weeks, scientists who participated in a news conference at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C., agreed that life on Venus seemed more probable as a result of the discovery that the planet's atmosphere contains water vapor. From Astronautics Magazine, April 1960, page 8. John Strong of Johns Hopkins has found more water vapor above the cloud layer of Venus than in die Earth's own stratosphere. 15 to 30 microns on Venus to 6 on Earth. During February 1960, a surprising statement was issued. Dr. Edward G. Pendry, founder of the American Rocket Society, stated, "Venus may turn out to be a wonderful place to live. We don't know much about its surface, because we can't see it. But it is about the same size as Earth and nearer to the sun, it may be like Florida all over." Spokesmen for the die-hard factions then clamored that life as Earthmen know it could not exist on Venus, because its atmosphere supposedly contains too much carbon dioxide and the planet's surface temperature is too high. Shortly after this statement was released to the public, scientists announced their discovery of heat zones above the Earth's atmosphere, with temperatures ranging above 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. They admitted the heat belts could prevent any accurate measurement of another planet's surface temperature. An interesting fact on planetary atmosphere was brought to light during January 1960, by Dr. Roger Revel of the Scripps Institute of Oceanography in La Jolla, California. Dr. Evel stated that Earthmen are greatly increasing the amount of carbon dioxide in their atmosphere as they burn more coal, oil and natural gas. He predicted an increase of perhaps 20% in atmospheric carbon dioxide in the next 100 years, that could mean a 100% increase in Earth's atmospheric carbon dioxide in less than 500 years. Perhaps our scientists will discover there is a relationship between the amount of carbon dioxide in a planet's atmosphere and the age of that planet's civilization. When I first stated that people on Venus enjoy far better health and a longer lifespan than Earth's inhabitants, my statements were instantly ridiculed. Another new theory was presented in January 1960 by Dr. Vincent Arsky, then president-elect of the American Medical Association. Dr. Arsky reported to his colleagues that Earthmen now stand at the threshold of an age in which they will be able to control evolution. He said that within 50 years, Earth people could develop into a race of supermen with perfect health, high intelligence and a life expectancy of 125 years. You could hear the skeptics snickering around the world when I stated in Inside the Spaceships that the moon has an atmosphere. Information radioed back from the Russian rocket which landed on the moon in 1959 apparently sobered a few scoffers. According to Aviation Week magazine, the rocket reported that the moon is enveloped by a blanket or belt of low-energy ionized gases. The article suggested that a blanket of such gases would resemble an atmosphere. What did American scientists think of this announcement? NASA's John Townsend said the discovery of an ionosphere above the moon was very significant and surprising to him. The detection of an ionosphere at a relatively high distance from the moon means that the moon has a definite atmosphere, a condition that a few scientists could only guess at before, Townsend stated. When I said that the space people had told me our solar system has 12 planets, instead of 9 as we previously believed, the skeptics openly scoffed. In February 1960, Russian astronomers at the Kazakhstan Astrophysical Institute announced they had confirmed the existence of another planet beyond the orbit of Pluto, which had been previously termed the outermost planet of our solar system. Questioned on their reaction to the Russian claim, American astronomers asked for more details so they could check for themselves. Dr. Gustav Bukos of the Smithsonian Institute in Boston said the irregularities in Pluto's orbit have suggested there might be another planet beyond. Similar irregularities in the orbit of Neptune led to the discovery of Pluto in 1930. When I related meeting a man from the planet Mars, in Inside the Spaceships, that statement was ridiculed. During 1959, a science editor for United Press International reported, "The most refined test to date of whether there is life on the planet Mars has added to the evidence that there is. But the evidence is still far from conclusive." Dr. William Sinton of Lowell Observatory has already concluded, with the help of the 200-inch Hale telescope on Mount Palomar, that the dark regions of Mars may be great patches of vegetation, some of it similar to that on Earth. Wells Webb, research scientist at the University of California, stated in 1958 that, because of their complex geometric designs, the famed Martian canals were definitely constructed by intelligent beings. Then in 1960, we read a statement published by Russian physicist I.S. Shklovsky, who said he believed the two moons of Mars, Phobos and Deimos, are artificial satellites. Shklovsky based his opinions on studies of their highly reflective surfaces and eccentric orbits, which indicate Phobos and Deimos are hollow, man-made satellites. The old arguments that life as Earthmen know it could not exist on other planets of our solar system were based primarily on readings taken with two astronomical standbys, the spectrograph and the thermocouple. This brings up another point for discussion. Strange reports have been radioed from American and Russian satellites orbiting the Earth. They conclusively proved that life as we know it could not exist on Earth. After analyzing our globe from outer space with astronomical spectrographs, the satellites reported, no oxygen or water vapor exists in Earth's atmosphere. The answer, according to our scientists, was that the electrified layer of our ionosphere effectively blocked the spectrum lines of oxygen and water. The lines simply did not register. in view of their findings, and since a similar ionospheric shell exists around every planet, it is evident that spectrographic analysis of another planet's atmosphere cannot be termed reliable when it is taken from outside the planet's ionosphere. The spectrograph may be useful in analyzing light emitted from the Sun and other stars, but it is obviously unreliable when used to study light reflected from another planet. Only space probes beneath the ionospheres of other planets will give us true measurements of their atmospheric conditions. In regard to the thermocouple, its readings may be accurate when taken from outside our ionosphere, but, like the spectrograph, it is useless when operated within our ionospheric shell. After all, we have thermal bands around the Earth that measure from 1000 to 4000 degrees Fahrenheit. I believe these bands would make our planet seem inhospitably warm to an extraterrestrial observer. Before we leave the topic of spectrums, let me put an end once and for all to wild rumors of little green men landing on Earth from our solar planets. The space people have told me the warm-blooded oxygen-breathing mammal we call man exists throughout the universe with the same variety in facial features, coloring, height and weight as found on Earth. Man is the most highly developed creature on every inhabited planet. Nature has provided a protective filtration device for thin-skinned man which we call skin pigmentation. The pigments, which cause skin coloration, serve merely to filter out harmful portions of the solar radiation spectrum, thereby protecting sensitive tissues beneath the skin. Our sun emits radiation that, in the atmospheres of solar planets, has a definite reddish cast. The filtering pigments screen out the red portion of the sun's spectrum and therefore our skin coloration tends toward warm colors, red, yellow, pink, bronze, and brown. It is remarkable that Earthmen have attached such false importance to skin coloration, when it merely serves as a natural protective device. When I reported that the moon was being used as a base by space people, the skeptics replied that if there were people on the moon, we could see them from Earth. They also claimed humans could not survive on the airless, waterless lunar landscape. At a space conference in Nice, France during January 1960, Dr. Harold C. Urey of the University of California told his colleagues the moon may not be as dead as has been supposed. He said there is still reason to believe there is radiation around the moon, now a proven fact, which would suggest various life-giving components, including water, underneath the moon's surface. Dr. Raymond Doctuck of the University of Maryland stated in December 1959 that the existence of some kind of life on the moon could not be ruled out. Soviet science writer F. Siegel echoed, "The concept of the moon as a dead world needs revision." Siegel referred specifically to strange spots of changing color and location which have been observed at the bottom of certain lunar craters. On page 226 of Inside the Spaceships we read, "In the numerous large craters of the moon, which you see from Earth, you will notice very large hangars. We have built these hangars on such a scale in order that much larger ships than this one can enter easily." When a ship enters these hangars, a process of depressurizing the passengers takes place. This requires about 24 hours. In the January 1958 issue Sky and Telescope, published by Harvard College Observatory, we find the following information on page 138. "In recent years, amateur astronomers have been paying increasing attention to lunar domes, small rounded hills that are being observed in increasing numbers. The domes referred to above are white and look symmetrical as if they were turned out of chalk on a lathe. They have appeared in lunar craters over the past few years until now over 200 have been charted. And some astronomers still contend that nothing ever changes on the moon. Astronomers previously claimed the moon was airless, yet even before the Russian rocket found lunar atmosphere, many observers had seen meteors flaring into incandescence as they approached the moon. An atmosphere must be present before friction such as that could exist." Walter Hers, astronomer at Ohio State University, reports he has observed meteor flashes above the moon, but no sign of impact, indicating that the moon has an atmosphere sufficient to burn up meteors. Astronomers have estimated that up to 100,000 meteors per hour approach the moon. If the moon really had no atmosphere, these meteors should strike so hard as to radically alter the lunar landscape every hour. If this were to occur, the new craters could be readily observed through our telescopes, since the Russian rocket, which was only 87 inches long and 47 inches in diameter, made quite a splash itself. The cloud of dust and gas that rose when the rocket landed was estimated to be from 310 to 560 miles high. Without an atmosphere, such clouds could not be raised. When the first satellites radioed back their information, Earth's people were probably surprised to hear scientific reports which stated, in parallel terms, exactly what I had written in my books at least 3 years before. For example, on page 76 of Inside the Spaceships I reported, I was amazed to see that the background of space is totally dark. Yet there were manifestations taking place all around us, as though billions upon billions of fireflies were flickering everywhere, moving in all directions, as fireflies do. However, these were of many colors, a gigantic celestial fireworks display that was beautiful to the point of being awesome. On page 77, I continued, space and its activity held me transfixed as I strained my eyes in an attempt to see everything that was going on apart from the firefly effects. I saw a good many large luminous objects passing through space. The larger bodies, so far as I could tell, were not burning, but merely glowing. The same findings were revealed by scientists in January, 1960. Outer space is a dazzling vision of multicolored brightness, not a black void, a Moscow radio science commentator reports. He says this was learned from the Soviet Sputniks and adds, it is very bright and colored like a rainbow because interplanetary gas shines with a multicolored light, while thousands of millions of stars shine through it, forming almost solid-looking pinky gold or dazzling white shapes. A subsequent report from our own scientists stated that space, instead of being an empty vacuum as formerly thought, is actually filled with billions of particles of matter, all in a constant state of activity and glowing with a weird fluorescence of their own. In Inside the Spaceships I also told of large radiation belts building up around the Earth. The hazards they present were fully outlined on pages 91-92. 3 years later, in August 1958, we read in the newspapers, Explorer 4 is sending back quite startling revelations about an intense band of radiation far out in space, a project official said today. George Ludwig, an associate in the physics department of the State University of Iowa, said early data from Explorer 4 shows that the radiation is lethal. Ludwig said above 1,200 miles the reentrant ratings have been amazing. Once again we find valid evidence of prior knowledge, confirmed years later by scientific reports. Of course, I didn't call the radiation zones Van Allen belts, I have never met the gentleman for whom they are named. In Flying Saucers Have Landed, I reported that the spaceships were magnetically propelled. Our scientists had previously demonstrated magnetic propulsion on a laboratory scale, but the skeptics were still unwilling to admit that flying saucers could be propelled by anything so simple, relatively speaking, as electromagnetism. In November, 1959, the International Telephone and Telegraph Corporation announced that its scientists had developed a device which produced high-voltage electricity from the radiant energy of a sunbeam. The firm said its device could produce extremely high voltages to provide power for propelling spaceships. A prominent physicist, Dr. Y. C. Lee, announced several months earlier that electrical propulsion could speed Earthmen through space at velocities eventually reaching 3 million miles per hour. On pages 237 and 238 of Inside the Spaceships we find an account of the tilting of the Earth's axis, wherein the space people stated our planet has already begun a slow, nearly imperceptible tilt. According to the space travelers, the tilt is part of a cycle which occurs at regular intervals in every planet's development. In February, 1960, scientists reported finding evidence at the South Pole of fern-like plants, spores, pollen, plant tissue, forest and even beds of coal, which is fossilized vegetation. Dr. George Lano, American lichenologist, said this evidence indicates the South Pole received more sunlight in past centuries than it does now. Dr. Lucy Gramwell of New Zealand said the evidence indicated that forests once grew in Antarctica like those now common in southern South America. On the basis of this evidence, scientists believe a change may have occurred in the Earth's axis of rotation. While my statements have been critically received in some quarters, I have aided the scientists whenever possible. In return, many scientists have assisted me in the gentlemanly, dignified manner which befits any serious student of science. Recent findings do not wholly prove my previous statements, but in their parallel pattern they conclusively prove the wisdom of keeping one's mind receptive to new knowledge. 8. Rumors and rumor-mongers. I have received many letters from people who are confused by certain wild rumors that are, year after year, circulated against me. It is a mystery how some of these tales get started. A few are deliberate falsehoods apparently designed to discredit my experiences in the eyes of the public. Others are so absurd as to make one wonder about the mental status of the individuals who originate or spread such tales. Even people who do not accept the reality of my experiences refuse to believe some of these stories. In December, 1958, a spaceman took me from a train near Kansas City, Missouri, and after driving me to his ship, we flew to Davenport, Iowa, where I disembarked after dark. A nationally known source of publication charged that my story was a fabrication and proceeded to publish a distorted, non-factual account of what was supposed to really have happened. Needless to say, most of this supposed expose was outright fabrication itself. The investigator for the publication was a man who claimed to be a contactee himself. He claimed communication by means of trance. People he talked to reported he used a phony badge and impersonated an officer, which in itself is an illegal act. On one occasion he gathered a group of people, including some newsmen, at a place where a saucer was supposed to land. Up to the last he claimed to be in mental contact with the crew of the saucer. When it failed to appear, he was laughed out of the group he claimed to represent and turned to discrediting other groups and individuals. It is entirely likely that the publication which used the investigator's phony expose of me was unaware of the man's record of falsehoods. The fact remains that no effort was made to correct the situation after the director of the organization was notified of the deception used against him. He has consistently pursued the same course in the past. Never once has he asked me about my claims. Instead, he jumps on any discrediting information and publishes it without verification. This well-known, self-styled UFO investigator, with headquarters in Washington, D.C., stated in his second book that I ran a hamburger stand on the road to the Mount Palomar Observatory. He said I had a telescope on the roof of the stand and implied that running such a stand was detrimental to my scientific interests. A mutual friend in Washington advised this fellow to pay me a visit, or at least spend a 3-cent stamp, in order to get the true facts before publishing his book. Evidently he didn't feel it was worth the trouble. Palomar Gardens Cafe has accommodated many notable visitors. These people, from all over the world, probably wouldn't have signed the guest register in a mere hamburger stand. Many guests told Mrs. Alice Gay Wells, the owner, that her cafe had been well recommended by friends, and was one of the highlights of their trip. I have never owned a business, nor was I employed in any capacity at the Palomar Gardens Cafe. My wife and I lived on the property and I had set up my two telescopes there. One was a 15-inch reflector which stood in a nearby clearing. It was housed in a small dome observatory. The other, a 6-inch reflector, was portable and could be carried in an automobile. This 6-inch scope was the instrument used in photographing the pictures shown in my previous books. These were my own instruments and were in no way connected with the Palomar Observatory. Although I was acquainted with several scientists at the Palomar Observatory, I have never been employed as a member of the observatory, or even claimed to be a member of the observatory's staff. The observatory had no one to give out information, so many people would ask questions at the cafe in regard to its operation. I often conversed with guests in the cafe dining room, on astronomy and other topics. When the spacecraft arrived, I was in a position to answer many questions and to give free lectures for service clubs. Some newspapers used the term hamburger vendor in a derogatory sense, hinting I was a nobody who had jumped on the flying saucer bandwagon.